Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We'll be finishing the section that we started earlier, which really goes from chapter 28 through chapter 33. Now, the reason we know that it's a literary unit, it's often called the woe section because the word woe appears so many times through here. Now, we need to pick up on the background if we could. Remember that chapters 28 through 33 is basically God's reaction through his prophet to Hezekiah's attempt to go to Egypt for help against Assyria instead of going to God for help against Assyria. And we can see that so clearly in chapter 31:1, where it talks about woe to those who go down to Egypt for help. Now we're picking up that same context in chapter 32. We believe the historical setting is the invasion of Sennacherib in 701 B.C., where he had already conquered 46 walled villages of Judah, and now he comes to the very gates of Jerusalem herself. If you want to see what happened, you ought to read Isaiah chapter 36 and 37, for what God's promises are sure. Notice in verse 32 where it says, "Behold, the king will reign righteously, and the princes will rule justly, and each will be like," and there's a series of metaphors. I have a graphic on this king because I think it's hard for us to understand exactly what this reference is to. Notice, if you would, that we are dealing with a messianic context. Under number 2 there, you'll see that Isaiah itself deals with this miraculous child who's going to have a tremendous government and be of the shoot of Jesse. Now, verses 1 through 8 reflect this godly king. Now, this godly king is going to have many godly helpers or princes. So it's one man with his administration going to establish a godly society. Okay, and inside this society, there are several desert metaphors used to describe what it's going to be like. It'll be like a refuge from the wind, like a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land. And so these are all desert metaphors that speak of the stability, the comfort, the security of this new king. The king seems to reflect both a local historical king like Hezekiah and ultimately, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, and his reign when he comes again. Now, in verse 3, it mentions the background seems to reflect that the eyes of those who have been blinded will be opened, the ears of those who have been closed will be opened, the mind of the hasty will discern truth, and the tongue of the stammerer will speak clearly. Now, I really believe that this is related to chapter 6, verse 9 and 10. Chapter 6 is the call of Isaiah. In that chapter, God said, "Isaiah, I'm going to give you a message, but I want you to know when you preach it, they're not going to hear you. They're going to reject your message." And Isaiah said, "Oh, how long?" Well, this is the how long is over now, and the people who were spiritually blinded and spiritually deaf are going to be able to hear and see. So it refers not so much to physical restoration as the discernment of spiritual truth. Now, verse 5 shows us that even in this ideal society, in this righteous government, there's going to be fools and rogues. Now, these fools and rogues are going to be present, but they're going to be understood for who they are. They're going to be recognized and somewhat ostracized from places of leadership. Verses 6 through 8 describe the fools and the rogues of verse 5. Now, beginning in verse 9 through 14, we're going to speak to the rich, affluent society of Isaiah's day. And we're going to use the literary example of the rich society women. Now, we're not just speaking to the rich women. We're speaking to all of the luxury and extravagance of Isaiah's day in its wealth and opulence. But we're going to use the metaphor of society women, okay? That's verses 9 through 14. You might want to see chapter 3, 16 through 4, 1, where this same literary technique is used. Notice it mentioned in verse 10, "within a year and a few days." This is a very, very specific time reference for a prophecy. I think we're very close to the invasion of Sennacherib in 701 in this chapter right here. Now, notice it, down in verse 11, "Tremble, you women who are at ease. Be troubled, you complacent daughters. Strip, undress, and put on sackcloth on your waist. Beat your breast for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine." Now, there's been much discussion about what this is talking about. I really believe there are two possible interpretations of the last part of verse 11 and the first part of 12. Let me show you a graphic or we can walk through this together. There seems to be two basic possibilities. One is that verse 11 and 12 refer to mourning rites. Now, if you, my New American Standard, which I use when I study the Old Testament, in verse 11 adds the term sackcloth. So it's saying it understands it as mourning rites. When anything's in italics, it means it's not in the regular text. That would make the next verse, verse 12, the beating of one's breast speak of another kind of sign of grief or mourning. But now, contextually, I really believe number two is better. There are three imperatives in verse 11. Strip yourself, take off. No, I think it's getting ready, taking someone's clothes down to the waist, women included, for beating or lashing. That makes verse 12 would be a series of three unfruitful things. The women would not bear children anymore. Their breasts would be bare. The fields would not grow crops, and the vine would not grow grapes. Now, I really think option number two fits the context much better than the signs of mourning. Now, let's skip down a little bit, if we could. Verse 14 is going to speak of the destruction of Jerusalem, which we know did not happen in Isaiah's day under Hezekiah, but much later in Jeremiah and Ezekiel's day under Babylon. Notice where it says, the word will become caves forever, the last part of verse 14. This is the Hebrew word olam. And this is a perfect example of showing the relativeness of this word. It did not happen in Isaiah's day. It happened in Babylon's day, but after the exile, it was restored. So be careful of reading our understanding of eternal into the Hebrew word olam. It'll really get you in trouble. Now, in verse 15, we're talking about the Spirit is poured out from on high. Until the Spirit is poured out. It's a real drastic break from this is the way it is to this is the way it's going to be. Now, there are several passages in the Old Testament that reflect God pouring out His Spirit on mankind. Joel 2, 28 and 29, quoted by Peter on Pentecost, is one. Ezekiel 12, 10. Isaiah 44, 3. And, of course, Acts 2, 1 through 21 is the ultimate fulfillment where Peter talks about Joel chapter 2. Now, there are seven things that the Spirit brings when He is poured out. Now, really here, we can't read too much of our Trinitarian New Testament doctrine back into the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the Spirit of God is the power and presence of God to act on God's will. Well, what happens when God's presence and will is manifested in society? Well, seven things are going to characterize a society or a people or a land when God's Spirit is poured out. And here's a graphic to go through those. First of all, there's going to be abundant fertility, verse 15. Then there's going to be a society of justice, verse 16. Then there's going to be a personal lifestyle of righteousness, verse 16. There's going to be peace, quietness, and confidence, verse 17. And then there's going to be undisturbed resting places. Verse 18 has three different ways of saying that very same thing. An undisturbed land, undisturbed home, undisturbed fields, real security and peace. Now, verse 19 has really caused commentators problems. It seems out of place that in the middle of the blessing of God on Jerusalem, the pouring out of His Spirit, that we're back to the judgment of Jerusalem, because that's previous context. Now, I really think, and listen to me good now, because this is going to be a little hard to follow, I really think that verse 19 refers not to the destruction of Jerusalem, but to the destruction of Assyria, which is talked about in this whole context. And I will tell you why. Notice it says, when the forest comes down. In chapter 10, verse 18 and 19, and chapter 10, verse 33 and 34, that is used as a metaphor for the fall of Assyria. Now, when it says, the city will be ultimately laid low, it does not say Jerusalem specifically, and there are several references in this context where we're talking about Nineveh being destroyed. Isaiah 24, 10, Isaiah 25, 2 and 3, and Isaiah 26, 5 are references where the city refers to Nineveh. Now, notice, if you would, how in verse 20, we're coming back to this idea of blessing again, and it says, how blessed you will be, you who sow beside all waters, who let freely the ox and the donkey. Now, there's been great diversion of opinion here what this means. I really think that we can catch the essence of it, maybe not the particularness of it, if we say, there's going to be such fertility and abundance in nature. The crops are going to be so huge and so large that even if you let your animals run free and they eat some of the crop, it really won't affect anything because the crops will be so large. Now, I think that's what verse 20 is all about. In chapter 33, we're reflecting a basic pattern through this section of Isaiah And once you see this basic pattern, you'll see how most of the chapters fit into it. The pattern runs like this. The current state of the rebellious people of God is explained. Then God's judgment by a foreign power is prophesied. And finally, the future glorious conditions of the reign of the Messiah are stipulated. And that's what I think we have all the way through here. Notice the word woe begins chapter 33. That's why I think 28 through 33 is a literary context. Chapter 28:1, chapter 29:1, 29:15, chapter 31:1, and then here in 33. And so we need to follow that. You see that woe all the way through. This is a funeral type lament. We would call it a dirge. Okay? Now, I believe verse 1 speaks of the nation of Assyria. God used Assyria as his tool to judge his people. Isaiah 10:5, Assyria, the rod of my anger. But Assyria was still responsible for her godless, cruel acts, and God will hold her responsible, and she will pay the price. Now, that's the kind of thing we have to struggle with somebody like Judas. Did God know he would do it? Did God force him to do it? God knew he would do it, but Judas is responsible. Now, both those aspects are biblical truth. God elects and God knows what's going to happen before it happens. But man and nations are always responsible for their acts. That's just the way it is. Now, verse 2 seems to be a prayer as well as a prophecy combined by the prophet. Now, that's highly unusual to mix prayer and prophecy. But the prophet is in a very agitated, emotional state, and he does it. O Lord, notice it's the word Yahweh, the covenant name from God, Exodus 3:15, from the Hebrew verb to be. I am that I am, the ever-living God. O Lord, be gracious to us, for we have waited for thee. Be thou their strength every morning. Now, the word strength is the word arm. God does not have an arm. God is spirit. But we use anthropomorphic terms to describe God. I remember a few years ago on Mother's Day, I preached on the femininity of God. My ladies just loved it. But it's basically what I was doing was talking about human language to describe God. If you'd like that tape, The Femininity of God, please write us. We'll make it available to you. So this is an anthropomorphic phrase using the power. Usually it's God's right arm for power is used in the Bible. Now, every morning, this is a beautiful thing. It reminds me of the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6:11, where it says, give us each day our daily bread. God wants to develop a relationship with us where we trust him day by day for our needs. That's what we, not a great emotional or religious act or experience, but a day-by-day walk of fellowship is what God wants for our lives. Now, our salvation also in the times of distress. We need to remember that the Hebrew word for salvation is synonymous with the Hebrew word for deliverance. So whenever in the Old Testament we're talking about salvation, we're talking about physical deliverance. Now, let's see. Notice in verse 6 we have the word stability. Really, this is the word faithfulness, but I really think it's used in the sense of security, and that's what we're talking about. Now, in verse 6, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge, the fear of the Lord is his treasure. What a beautiful passage on a correct understanding of who God is. God is our wisdom. God is our salvation. God is our knowledge, and he himself is our greatest treasure. Not gold or silver. God, knowing God, is the greatest blessing. The most valuable thing in all of existence is knowing God. And that's what, of course, the prophet has come to. Now, notice where it mentions here, behold, their brave men cry in the streets. Now, verses 7 through 9 seem to reflect the breaking down of the negotiations between Hezekiah's representatives and Sennacherib's representatives that's described in 2 Kings 18, 13 through 16. Now, Hezekiah tried to buy off Sennacherib. He gave him a lot of money, but Sennacherib came anyway, and these verses seem to reflect that. Now, the term brave men. Remember back in chapter 29, we dealt with the term Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, and we said that it could mean line of God or hearth of God. And I believe because of the usage here, it means hearth of God. But the background to that term can mean warriors or brave men. I think this term brave men is built on the same stem as Ariel that's used so much throughout this context for Jerusalem. And you can read 7 through 9 and see how it fits. I'll go into verse 13 if I could. Notice where it says, "You who are far away, hear what I have done. You who are near, acknowledge my might." Now I think in context that refers to the Jews who were already in captivity in Assyria. 9 and 10 tribes have been gone since 722. This is about 20 years later. And the Jews who were in Judah, who were about to be exiled, they thought, by Assyria. What God's saying is, you Jews who are far away and you Jews who are near, watch what I'm going to do for you. Now, I think in a fuller messianic context, a New Testament context, that we're talking in a similar language to what Paul used in Ephesians 2 and 3. You who are far off have now been brought near. And so it refers to Gentiles and Jews in its larger messianic context, but exiled Jews and still free Jews in its historical context. Now, notice where it mentions here in verse 14. Who among us can live with a consuming fire? And who among us can live with continual burning? Well, this is the idea of God as represented by fire and smoke. Remember Mount Sinai? When God came down on Mount Sinai, it was like a thunderstorm, lightning, smoke, trembling, earthquakes, terrified the people. God's presence many times is depicted by the Shekinah cloud of glory, the great brilliant light. And so that's what it's referring to, is the presence of God. It could be for judgment, could be for blessing. It's just God's presence symbolized in a consuming fire. You might want to see Deuteronomy 4:24, Deuteronomy 5:24, Isaiah 30, verse 27, and verse 30 for some other examples of God as a consuming fire. Okay? Let's see. Verses 15 and 16 now reflect the characteristics of the people who live in this new day of righteousness. Really, they reflect the character of God Himself. In the Old Testament, the goal of righteousness is to be like God. The word righteousness is a term that means a straight edge, a measuring reed. And it's used to describe God Himself. What God wants is His characteristics manifested in human society and in human individuals. Now, that we would call that from the New Testament Christ-likeness. Here, these characteristics of God exemplified in society, we can also see those in Psalms 15 and Psalms 24, 3 through 6. And so we need to look at that. Now, in verse 17, I think it's very important. Notice it describes this king again, this ambiguous king. Remember, we started off this lesson in chapter 32 with a king and his prince. I really think that reflects this marvelous, miraculous child king that's been talked about in chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 11, and all the way through here in a rather ambiguous way. And we're coming back to that king. Now, you see, back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 7, God was meant to be the king of the people of Israel. He was their king. But then they wanted a king themselves, like the other nations. So God gave them a man to rule on throne. But that man was supposed to be an ideal representative of God Himself. Now, we know that the promises about the Messiah are through David, one of the greatest kings Israel ever had. And so the coming Messiah is seen as a king himself. And so I think we have to look at historically and also ultimately here. Your eyes will see the king in his beauty. It's much like 32:1, and so you might want to see that. Now, when it says they'll behold a far distant land, that may be that the far lands will see him. I think that's a little bit better there. Now, your heart will meditate on terror. Where is he who counts? Where is he who weighs? Where is he who counts towers? Now, that's a rather unusual little phrase. What could that possibly mean in the context of a messianic king? Well, again, we must remember that the historical context is the invasion of Judah by Sennacherib in 701 B.C. We learn that he just destroyed cities in his wake. Probably this refers to the king's military representatives or reconnoiterers who came and tried to count the number of towers, the number of fortifications, the number of gates in the city of Jerusalem. As he had to count these number of gates and towers, what basically he did was to try to see the strength of the city. Okay, so I think it's referring to the representatives of Sennacherib. Now, in verse 19, I think that Verse 19 corroborates what I think about the previous verse, because it mentions a people of unintelligible speech, which no one can comprehend, and of a stammering tongue, which no one can understand. Back in chapter 28, verse 11, that's used of Assyria. Now, the Assyrian language and Aramaic are somewhat related, but still very different. The Jews were not able to understand those foreign powers. Couldn't understand them talking. And I think that's what it's referring to here. Now, in verse 20, look upon Zion, the city of the appointed feast. Remember that God in Deuteronomy said, I'm going to pick a place where my name will dwell. Now, he picked Jerusalem. Now, I want to stop a minute and think with me. Why is Jerusalem called Mount Zion? The temple is not on Mount Zion. The temple is on Mount Moriah. But Mount Zion came to be, it's where David's tomb is today. It came to be a metaphor for the whole city of Jerusalem, Mount Zion. That's how it's used here. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which shall not be folded. Its stakes shall never be pulled up, nor shall any of its cords be torn apart. You might well see chapter 36 and 37, where Sennacherib comes right to the gate. Everybody thought the city was going to fall. Now, just for a moment, I want to talk about this, because later in Jeremiah's day, this is what the false prophets were quoting. Ladies and gentlemen, we must remember that we can't pull the Bible out of its context. We must realize that for every unconditional promise of God, there is a conditional response demanded of man. What God's saying is, Jerusalem will never be destroyed, and what is not said but implied is, if you follow me, love me, keep my commands, and walk in my ways, I'll keep this city from all harm. But if you don't, if you break my covenant, if you kill my prophets, if you live unrighteous, unjust, ungodly, exploitative lives, I'll take my presence from you and you'll fall. Now, the false prophets in Jeremiah's day were saying peace and security. They were saying, God saved the city under Hezekiah and Isaiah. God will save the city today. He wouldn't let this city fall. He promised it'd never be destroyed. Now, this is not a contradiction of the Bible or the lack of fulfillment of prophecy. It is a recognition that all of God's relationship with man are based on an unconditional promise followed by a condition based on man's individual response. We must remember that. Now, look at verse 21. But there is a majestic one, the Lord shall be for us, a place of rivers and of wide canals. A boat with oars shall go. Now, why? People have said, well, there's been as many interpretations of this little phrase because Israel has no rivers. Israel has no boats, no navigable waterways except the Sea of Galilee. This is talking about rivers. And so we wonder, what does this mean? Well, I think it is an allusion to the power of Egypt and the Nile River. For you see, this whole context is dealing with the folly of God's people going to a foreign power for security. And what I think it's coming back to as it closed this section is, you're going to have all the blessings of a nation like Egypt. Trust me. So it's the metaphor of the abundance and fruitfulness and power of Egypt used for the abundance and fruitfulness and power of God in the nation of Israel. Now in verse 23, your tackle hangs slack. It cannot hold the base of its mast firmly, nor spread out its sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil be divided, the lame will take the plunder, and no resident will say, I am sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. This seems to refer, verse 23, to the downfall of Assyria. She was unprepared. She was not expecting what would happen. She's going to fall. She's going to fall. Now, in verse 24, is God promising his people, I'm going to bring you home. I'm going to bring you home. You see, it's so devastating to us. We're in a context of the threat of exile and the promise of God's saving stability if his people turn to him. Now, that's the way it happened under Hezekiah. It's going to be just the reverse under Jeremiah. And when the people of God went into exile, the northern 10 tribes in 722, they're already gone. The southern two tribes are going to go into exile in 586 under Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar II. What they kept saying is, God's left us. God's deserted us. There's no hope. He doesn't care for us anymore. There's no relationship. We can't trust him anymore. Now, what God is saying is this: trust me. I'll forgive you. I'll bring you back. Trust me. You see, when a nation was defeated in these days, you must remember the nation was linked to its national deity. For the people of God to be taken by Assyria meant the Assyrian gods were more powerful than Israel's gods. That's the common mindset. And what God's saying is, I'm in control. Trust me. I'll forgive you. I'll bring you back. Trust me. Well, this is the end of this section, Isaiah chapter 28 through 33. I really hope you'll send for that tape about the anthropomorphic phrases used to describe God. That's such a difficult thing for us to handle because we're so used to saying God is male or God walks. We must remember that we have true knowledge about God, but not exhaustive knowledge about God. And the only way we can describe God, an ultimate, infinite, righteous being, the only way we can describe him is in terms that we understand about ourselves. Now, we are conscious beings, but we're not infinite and we're not holy. So our terms are inappropriate, but it's all we have. Now, that tape, the femininity of God, I think will really help you see that. I hope that you'll go back and look at chapters 28 through 33 together. Read them as a unit, and you'll really see how they fit the same time frame, they fit the same literary structure, and I think they're a good word for us. You know, one thing I've been amazed about Western culture, we like things black or white. We like things A or B. And whenever I get into the dialectic tension, the paradox of biblical truth, people always get nervous. You see, I do believe that God's covenant is unconditional and God's promise are eternally sure and true. But you see, I also believe that man must respond and continue to respond by faith. And so you can't say either or. It's got to be both and. It's called a dialectical way of looking at biblical truth. All biblical truth is paradoxical to man. And yet, those are the forms that we usually find it in. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. I hope you'll send for this tape and for our free catalog of over 2,000 tapes, both on video and audio, that we have available free. I've enjoyed being with you. Please pray for me as I study, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.